So this is the Tuesday night lifestyles classes. They're different from the Sunday classes, which are inspirational. These are more informational, and our topic today is Karma Yoga, based on the 47th verse in the second chapter. Karmani evada karaste mafala shukadachana makkarma falahetubur matte sangostu karmani. Krishna says to Arjuna, you have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you are not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself the cause of the results of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. So karma means action and reaction, the law of action and reaction, and yoga means linking. We get the English word yoke. So karma yoga means how to link with God through action. And that may go a little bit against our preconditioned idea of yoga. A lot of people think of yoga as being exclusively sort of a passive activity where you're sitting in asanas for a prolonged period of time and sort of controlling your breathing, minimizing your bodily movements. On the other hand, Arjuna was fighting a battle, a great war, a world war, but because he was doing it under the orders of Krishna, he was also doing yoga. He wasn't doing the dhyana or the asana or the pranayama type of yoga. He was doing what's called karma yoga. In other words, karma yoga are those activities for whom the beneficiary is God. By this definition, a seamstress can be a yogi. In fact, if you're talented and trained in seamstress, you can benefit God. You can glorify God more by following your own training and propensity than you can by putting on a show of being a yogini or yogi and crossing your legs and contorting your body. It's actually more yoga, because God created each one of us individually. He fashioned us. And so when you use the talents and abilities that God gave you to then glorify that person from whom they came, that is higher yoga. In other words, that's a more comprehensive way of linking back to the Lord than it is, you know, going to a gymnasium and twisting your body and so on and so forth. So karma yoga is the science of acting in such a way that the Lord benefits. And Brahmins are the ones who are supposed to be the most adept in the science of working on behalf of the Lord. In fact, Brahmins, the qualified Brahmins. Now, let me say that the caste system by birth is not the original intention. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says Chatur Varnam Mayasristam Guna Karma Vibhagasaha. There are four types of people that the Lord created. And these aren't specific to any nation or caste. Those four types of people are intellectuals, who tend to be the Brahmins. They are the administrators or warriors, who tend to be a little more passionate. There are the Vaishyas or mercantilists, and then there are the laborers and artisans and craftsmen. So of those, the more intelligent class of men, they tend to be the Brahmins. And the Brahmins are said to do two things on behalf of the Lord: to eat on behalf of the Lord and to speak on behalf of the Lord. If she could just be a little quiet down there, that would be good. So whenever a Brahmin speaks, they don't speak about politics or about sports or about... We were at the Indian Cultural Center the other day, and everybody was all abuzz with the Indian cricket match. The Indian was playing Pakistan in the world finals of the cricket match. And this was in the Indian Cultural Center. So a Brahmin would not be abuzz with sports topics or political topics. A Brahmin would be abuzz with topics about God. So whenever you go near a Brahmin, you know that you're going to get exposition about God. My friend Pranjivan sort of exhibited this quality, and nowadays it's all kind of mixed up. It's a little hard to identify. Some so-called Brahmins in India will smoke cigarettes and talk all nonsense, whereas Pranjivan, who was a simple shop owner in Los Angeles, had this drive, this passion for always talking about Krishna. And he would go to the parties where the Gujaratis would have parties. And when the Gujaratis come to America, they get very, very wealthy, and they adopt certain habits they wouldn't necessarily do in India: eating meat and drinking alcohol. But Pranjivan would go to the parties, and he would talk about Krishna. So there was always one corner, one part of the room where everything was just about Krishna. and various and sundry people would be attracted to that. And his wife would always be upset when they got home. She'd say, "Do you always have to talk about Krishna? Why don't you just go with the flow? You know, just go and talk about all the things that everyone and fit in, instead of always having this Krishna corner, you know, in the party." So one day Pranjeevan said, "Okay, I won't talk about Krishna." And he went to the party, and he was just standing there trying to fit in. And people were looking over at him, constantly glancing. The glances got more and more frequent. And finally, a whole contingent came over and said, "Pranjeevan, could you please talk about Krishna? You know, we miss it. We like it. We enjoy it, you see. So could you please just, I don't know why you're not, but we kind of expect you to talk about Krishna. So could you start your Krishna corner over there? It's part of our parties. We've come to expect it, anticipate it, relish it, and even enjoy it," like that. So that's the quality of a Brahmin. He speaks as a representative of God. Like the emissary of a king doesn't speak on his own. He just delivers the message that the king has given him. Prabhupada said, if there's any credit, because yogis come from India and some of them do magic tricks, produce a little ash, a little gold, and some of them are declared as incarnations and avatars and all these things. And Prabhupada said, "I did not do any tricks to get followers or to start a movement." He said, "My only credit is, here is the ancient message of Krishna as spoken in the Bhagavad Gita thousands and thousands of years ago. And I have just delivered it. My credit is that I didn't add anything, I didn't subtract anything, I didn't edit it, I just delivered it." Like the postman. Postman doesn't open up the letters, read them, and then say, "Well, you know, this sentence would be better expressed this way, cross out this sentence." He doesn't add or subtract, he just delivers it. So Prabhupada said, "I delivered the message of Krishna undiluted." And therefore the guru is known as a transparent via media. Through the lens of the guru, God comes into focus. We're not pure enough or qualified or elevated enough to be able to see the spiritual qualities of God. But a guru is one who has been trained by a previous guru, who has been trained by a previous guru, who has been trained by a previous guru, and they are actually like a lens through which the personality of Godhead becomes closer and bring into clarity, just like I was fiddling with this lens here in order to get a sharper picture. So in the presence of the guru, God becomes real. He becomes real because he is at the heart. He is in the heart of the guru, and the guru is in the heart of God. Prabhupada used to talk about the spiritual world and the kingdom of God and Krishna consciousness just as comfortably and familiarly and conversantly as I would talk about going to Macy's. I mean, you believe me, right, when I talk about going down there and turning right and turning left and going 2 miles past Chase Bank and the Cal Ranch stores and turning right on 900 North. You believe me. I've done it so many times. There's obviously a conviction there. There's a credibility. And when Prabhupada would speak about the spiritual world, you had the same conviction that this isn't theoretical knowledge. It's realized knowledge. And this isn't something that's peripheral. It's on the edge of his lifestyle. This is this is his heart. If you open up his heart like that, you'd see Krishna right there in the center of the heart. And most of us, we have God somewhere orbiting around, but it's our family members, it's our finances, it's our health, it's our recreation, it's our snowboarding, it's our bowling, or whatever it may be, it's the Cougar football team, or whatever it may be, is actually the thing that's in the center of our heart, and God's kind of around the edge. But you felt with Prabhupada that Krishna was actually at the very center of his being, the very center of his existence. And you never find a time, whether he was speaking to 1,000 people or whether you were in the room alone with him, as I was on several occasions, he would be speaking the same thing about Krishna based on the revealed scripture. So Brahman, people ask me, oftentimes students in world religions class may ask me, "What is a Brahman?" And I say there's three words that you might confuse with each other. One is Brahma, B-R-A-H-M-A, and that refers to the creator of the universe, Lord Brahma. When Lorenzo Snow says, "A man is God, was as God is, man will become," you could, if we were to translate in terms of our lexicon, you could say that we could become Brahmas. We could become creators and populators of universes in our next life. So as Brahma is, man will become as man is, Brahma was. Because in his previous life, Brahma was a man who was very pious and got elevated to that position. So that's one Brahma, B-R-A-H-M-A. And then there's Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N. And that refers to the effulgence, or the energies that emanate from the Lord. Just like the powerful sun globe, we don't just think of the sun. You can't. When you think of the sun, you think of the sunshine. Because they're supplementary and complementary. You can't have one without the other. So wherever you have an omnipotent supreme being, you have the diffusion. You have multifarious potencies emanating from him, just like from the sun, sunshine emanates. So those impersonal effulgent rays, they're referred to as Brahman. And the impersonalists, the school in India and other parts of the world that believe ultimately God is energy rather than being personal, they aspire to merge and to become one with that Brahman effulgence. And they often use the example of the drop of water merging back into the ocean. We don't subscribe to that because we see God as being ultimately personal. And ultimate liberation is not to become one with God, but to serve him in love and devotion. One in purpose, perhaps. Christ also said the Father and I are equal. He didn't mean that he was the same person as the Father, but it meant that what the Father's mission was in the world, Christ was totally focused in on that. He was doing the work of the Father. Just like if Lisa says, give me a glass of water, and I say, give Lisa a glass of water, it's the same thing. It's exactly this. So if God says surrender to me and Lord Jesus Christ says surrender to God, they're equal in purpose. And so this brings us to the third Brahma word. And as you see it written up on this word, B-R-A-H-M-I-N. Brahmin. And that refers to the more intelligent class of men who are dedicated in the service of the Lord and who speak on behalf of the Lord. Now the question may be raised, if the intelligent class of men do that, why is it that very few of our intelligentsia do that? Our intelligent people are scientists and they're doctors and they're lawyers, and hardly any of them talk about God or reflect God or glorify God. And the answer is they're not really intelligent. They're not really intelligent. There are different levels of knowledge and there are different levels of intelligence. The word techne is a Sanskrit word, actually, from which we get technology. So however well versed you may be in techne or technology, there are higher levels of spiritual knowledge. Technology is basically a workhorse mechanical knowledge which you use to provide a roof over your head and food on the table. It's knowledge by which you make a living. Now, a gorilla has the same knowledge. He knows how to get these big nuts. No other animal can eat them. He knows how to get these big nuts in his teeth or something, and he knows how to break the nuts and eat them. So that's basically his technology, and we have our technology, and it's all for the purpose of keeping body and soul together. But there's another level of knowledge, which is described as Raja Vidya Raja Guyam, the king of knowledge. Just like you have various houses, you have cabins, you have garages, you have sheds, you have two-bedroom cinder block houses, you have four-bedroom houses, and then you have big mansions and woodland hills and alpine. So there's different categories of residences. There are different categories of knowledge. And the king of all knowledge is knowledge about God. And the Brahman, the truly intelligent person who has purified intelligence, is one who speaks on behalf of God. So whenever a Brahmin's coming with the tilak and the robes and all, you know that the conversation is going to be about God. It's like if you see a policeman coming, if we see the sheriff's, you know, not very often, but like twice a year, three times a year, we see the sheriff's car pull up. So everyone's going, but, you know, we're gonna talk about the law, you know, and whether we broke it or someone else broke it. But you know it's going to, this guy's going to come up and, you know, like that. And you're going to, yes, officer, yes, officer. Yes, officer. Yes, officer. Like that, you know. So because of the uniform, we kind of know what the tone and the subject matter of the conversation is going to be. So wherever they're devotees, kind of know, you know, what they're going to talk about. And if you're curious, or if you're having a problem, or if you're genuinely distressed or confused, then you can access them. They're only too willing. They're exhibiting their willingness in the form of their dress to to talk to you and try to alleviate any sort of material or mental problems you might be having. And then the soul is, I mentioned BRHMAN as the effulgent, the rays of the Lord, and I mentioned them as impersonal, but ultimately those rays are consisting of millions and millions of individual tiny spiritual sparks, and those are called Brahman. And the beginning of knowledge is called Aham Brahmasmi. Aham means I, and Brahmasmi means spirit. To know that I am spirit, that I am not this body. That's the beginning of knowledge. And that's why we say many, many so-called intelligent people are not actually wise people, because their knowledge is based on the body and knowledge of the body and providing for the body and comforts for the body and so on and so forth. Whereas real knowledge, spiritual knowledge, begins to know by knowing that I'm the soul. Now, anybody can be a Brahman. You don't have to be born the son of a Brahman in order to be a Brahman. Just like anyone from any walk of life, whether they're born a bricklayer's son or a taxi driver's son, if they have the aptitude and the drive and the ambition to go to medical school and become a doctor, then they are allowed to do that, especially in our democratic society. There's full facility. Anyone can go to Harvard, anyone can go to Johns Hopkins if they have the qualifications. If they don't have the qualifications, they'll have to find their own level. But it's not that because you're a son of a Brahmin, you automatically become a Brahmin. Because a Brahmin is a very specialized vocation. One has to be full of knowledge and one has to be pure in habit. Brahmins are meant to abstain from illicit sex. That means if they're single, they're celibate. If they're married, they're faithful. They're meant to abstain from gambling. They're meant to abstain from meat eating. And they're also meant to abstain from intoxication, which includes coffee, tea, and cigarettes. So they teach as much by their character as by their precepts. They teach by not as much so much what they say, but what they are. And so when the kids would go to school and be taught by the Brahmins, they would learn not only facts, but they would learn good character. They would learn good... And the Brahmins were always unpaid. They would never accept a salary. Only at the end of the semester, the parents would give some dakshina, some gift for the Brahmins. And whatever they were given, they accepted that. Because, again, they are representing God. And they are trusting God. Consider the lilies of the field. They give no thought for the morrow, yet they are arrayed in more glory than Solomon of all of his splendor. So they're trusting in God to provide for them. That they're speaking for God. They're doing God's work. They're representing God. And they're counting on God not to let them down. And when you think about it, the ant gets his little crumbs of food every day. The elephant gets his 500 kgs of food every day. Every living being gets fed. Of course, some of them are eating each other, and that's a topic for another talk. But the Lord has provided food for even the animals, even the atheists who decry God, who write books about God is dead and all like that. Still, they're getting their meals. God doesn't begrudge them. He's not so small-minded, so he, of course he's going to provide for those who are engaged in his loving devotional service. So anyone can become a Brahmin if he knows the science of the soul and he knows the science of Krishna consciousness, regardless of his background, his birth, and his religion. Humans can learn the nature of the soul, animals cannot. And again, this is why we say that many of the so-called intelligent people are not really intelligent, because one really becomes a human, not just by getting this human body. Nietzsche said there's a greater difference between the best human and the lowest human than there is between the lowest human and the animal. That means having taken this human body does not ensure that one has human consciousness. One has the potential. The animal does not have the potential to distinguish between its body and soul. If you talk to the parrot or the dog or the cat and you say, you're actually not that body, you're not a cat, you're a dog, you're an eternal spirit soul within the body, they're just going to look at you like, you know, where's the gravy train, or you know, where's the cat food? It just doesn't register. So similarly, if one has a human body, but he's not interested in hearing about the soul or in knowing who he really is beyond this body and mind, then he's really just called Dvipadi Pashu. The animals are called Chaturpadi Pashu, four-legged for the most part. But even though one is standing on two legs, if he's not interested in the soul or interested in God, then he's called two-legged animal. And that's the difference between the animal society and human society. We can understand the soul. One person justified the killing of animals, said that human beings have a right to kill animals because animals have no metaphysical sense, and humans do. Now that's true. Animals don't have a metaphysical. Physical means this physical body, and metta means above. So the animal doesn't have a physical, a sense of metaphysics. We've had lamas that have given birth to babies, stillborn babies, and yet they'll hover around the baby for days and days and days and days, long after the corpse. And we try to keep the, so they can sort of take leave of it, you know, gradually. We don't just take it away. But they actually don't understand that the life force is gone. They'll hang around and hang around and hang around and nurse it and nurse it and nurse it. And they don't understand that there's no person in there. That's just a bag of chemicals. But there's no soul, there's no individual in there. Whereas we as human beings, we can distinguish and we can learn the difference between a living body and a dead body. And if we fail to do that, then we're no better than the animals. Prabhupada gave a talk at MIT University one time, and he challenged the whole, it was a full auditorium. There were Nobel laureates there and the best students, and he said, what is the difference between a living body and a dead body? And no one could answer. Some said electrics, electronics, there's electrical. Prabhupada said, well then take, you know, hook up the dead body and put the electricity back and see if you can bring life. Someone said, well there's some chemicals missing. And Prabhupada said, well, take any chemicals you want, any chemical or combination, put it in the dead body and bring it back to life. Nobody had an answer. And this is the highest institution of learning in America. And yet nobody knew the difference between a living body and a dead body. Their only inadequate explanations had to do with physical components. But even a child in Krishna consciousness knows that what is missing when we call the body dead, what is missing is the eternal spirit soul. And that's the difference between human life and animal life. Theory versus practice. Got a few more minutes here. Theory versus practice. We can produce a machine, but we cannot produce the driver. Without the driver, the machine is useless. America, the Western countries, are very expert in mechanics. Never before, as far as we know in the history world, have mechanics and technology been advanced so far. But in India, the technology of the soul is been honed and fine-tuned and practiced for thousands and thousands of years. So you can actually have a nice arrangement between the two. It is said that America goes very fast, has good strong legs, goes very fast, but they're blind, they're spiritually blind. They don't know the difference between the soul and the body, they take the body as a self. Now India, on the other hand, has this knowledge from Bhagavad Gita and from scriptures and great saints and sages and the Brahminical culture since thousands of years, but their legs were considered broken by foreign conquests, Mughals and British, and the back was broken, the culture was broken and all that. But he said if you put the man who's lame but can see on the shoulders of the man who's blind but can run, then you have a good combination. So with Indian wisdom and Western technology, you have a good marriage. And that's why Prabhupada came to the West. So we could use the Western technology in order to glorify God and spread God consciousness all over the world. And you see here we have a computer, we have a projector, we have a screen, we have a sound system downstairs, we have cars, we have all these things. But again, we're performing karma yoga because we're not using these things in our own self-interest. We're using them in such a way as to glorify God and promote God consciousness. Karma yoga doesn't mean to give up. It doesn't mean to give up things. Sometimes people will say, well, if you're a yogi, if you're a spiritist, why do you have a watch? Why do you have a computer? Why do you drive? Karma yoga doesn't mean to give up things. It means to recognize that all things come from God and to give up the selfish use of those things. To use them, or if you're Mormon, the word is consecration, to consecrate them back to He from whom they come. And because God's spirit, everything that comes from God is by nature spirit. When we misuse it, then it becomes material. By the misuse of God's energies, then it becomes material. In other words, tainted, misused spiritual energy becomes material energy. See? So either we use it properly in the first place, or we reclaim it in the service of the Lord. Just like at the Festival of Colors. In a sense, for one day, we reclaimed All those kids, all their minds, all their energies. We said, come back to Krishna, come back, and just give it all to God for one day. And so we did that. We actually reclaimed all that energy back to the source of all energy from who it comes for one day. And so even though in their mind they were chanting and dancing and it wasn't that meaningful to them like it was to us, still they were performing karma yoga. They were actually performing karma yoga and getting purified in your heart. The performance of it doesn't necessarily depend upon the understanding. Just like if you touch fire, it's going to burn. You don't have to know all the physics of it. So the kids came and chanted and danced, and the name of God is not different from God, and the name is absolute, and so it's like touching fire when you chant the name of the Lord. And it doesn't matter what the delivery system is, whether it's hip-hop or rhythm and blues or Motown or folk or rock, it has an absolute effect. And when you agree to engage your body and your mind, your words and your energies, so that the Lord is benefited, then that's called karma yoga. Whether you're fighting, or whether you're sewing, or whether you're dancing, or whether you're feasting, or whatever it may be that you're doing. So that brings us right up to the time when we do the hatha yoga. And if I'll just ask if there's any questions, see if Hanuman's coming here.